Chapter 9. Familiar face with fixed eyes and an open mouth became visible in the intense obscurity amongst the boulders. She uttered a low cry and stood up. The face vanished, leaving her to gasp and shiver alone in the wilderness of stone heaps. But as soon as she had crouched down again to rest, with her head against the rock, the face returned, came very near, appeared eager to finish the speech that had been cut short by death only a moment ago. She scrambled quickly to her feet and said, "Colin, go away, or I will do it again." The thing wavered, swung to the right, to the left. She moved this way and that, stepped back, fancied herself screaming at it, and was appalled by the unbroken stillness of the night. She tottered on the brink, felt the steep declivity under her feet, and rushed down blindly to save herself from a headlong fall. The shingle seemed to wake up. The pebbles began to roll before her, pursued her from above, raced down with her on both sides, rolling past with an increasing clatter. In the peace of the night the noise grew, deepening to a rumor, continuous and violent, as if the whole semicircle of the stony beach had started to tumble down into the bay. Susan's feet hardly touched the slope that seemed to run down with her. At the bottom she stumbled, shot forward, throwing her arms out, and fell heavily. She jumped up at once, and turned swiftly to look back, her clenched hands full of sand as he had clutched in her fall. The face was there, keeping its distance, visible in its own sheen that made a pale stain in the night. She shouted, "Go away," she shouted at it with pain, with fear, with all the rage of that useless stab that could not keep him quiet, keep him out of her sight. What did he want now? He was dead. Dead men have no children. Would he never leave her alone? She shrieked at it, waved her outstretched hands. She seemed to feel the breath of parted lips, and, with a long cry of discouragement, fled across the level bottom of the bay. She ran lightly, unaware of any effort of her body. High sharp rocks that, when the bay is full, show above the glittering plain of blue water like pointed towers of submerged churches, glided past her, rushing to the land at a tremendous pace. To the left, in the distance, she could see something shining. A broad disk of light in which narrow shadows pivoted round the center like the spokes of a wheel. She heard a voice calling, "Hey! There!" and answered with a wild scream. So, he could call yet. He was calling after her to stop. Never. ... She tore through the night, past the startled group of seaweed gatherers who stood round their lantern paralyzed with fear at the unearthly screech coming from that fleeing shadow. The men leaned on their pitchforks staring fearfully. A woman fell on her knees, and, crossing herself, began to pray aloud. A little girl with her ragged skirt full of slimy seaweed began to sob despairingly, lugging her soaked burden close to the man who carried the light. Somebody said. The thing ran out towards the sea. Another voice exclaimed, "Colin, and the sea is coming back. Look at the spreading puddles. Do you hear, you woman there? Get up." Several voices cried together. "Yes, let us be off. Let the accursed thing go to the sea." They moved on, keeping close round the light. Suddenly a man swore loudly. He would go and see what was the matter. It had been a woman's voice. He would go. There were shrill protests from women, but his high form detached itself from the group and went off running. They sent an unanimous call of scared voices after him. A word, insulting and mocking, came back, thrown at them through the darkness. A woman moaned. An old man said gravely, "Colin, such things ought to be left alone." They went on slower, shuffling in the yielding sand and whispering to one another that Millet feared nothing, having no religion, but that it would end badly someday. Susan met the incoming tide by the Raven Islet and stopped, panting, with her feet in the water. She heard the murmur and felt the cold caress of the sea, and, calmer now, could see the somber and confused mass of the Raven on one side, and on the other the long white streak of Mullen sands that are left high above the dry bottom of Fougere Bay at every ebb. She turned round, and saw far away, along the starred background of the sky, the ragged outline of the coast. Above it, nearly facing her, appeared the tower of Plowmer Church, a slender and tall pyramid shooting up dark and pointed into the clustered glitter of the stars. She felt strangely calm. She knew where she was, and began to remember how she came there, and why. She peered into the smooth obscurity near her. She was alone. There was nothing there, nothing near her, either living or dead. The tide was creeping in quietly, putting out long impatient arms of strange rivulets that ran towards the land between ridges of sand. Under the night the pools grew bigger with mysterious rapidity, while the great sea, yet far off, thundered in a regular rhythm along the indistinct line of the horizon. Susan splashed her way back for a few yards without being able to get clear of the water that murmured tenderly all around, and, suddenly, with a spiteful gurgle, nearly took her off her feet. Her heart thumped with fear. This place was too big, and too empty to die in. Tomorrow they would do with her what they liked. But before she died she must tell the gentleman in black clothes that there are things no woman can bear. She must explain how it happened. She splashed through a pool, getting wet to the waist, too preoccupied to care. She must explain. He came in the same way as ever and said, just so. Do you think I am going to leave the land to those people from Morbihan that I do not know? Do you? We shall see. Come along, you creature of mischance. Apostrophe and he put his arms out. Then, messieurs, I said. Before God, never. ... and he said, striding at me with open palms. There is no God to hold me. Do you understand, you useless carcass? I will do what I like. ... and he took me by the shoulders. Then I, messieurs, called to God for help, and next minute, while he was shaking me, I felt my long scissors in my hand. His shirt was unbuttoned, and, by the candlelight, I saw the hollow of his throat. I cried. Let go. ... He was crushing my shoulders. He was strong, my man was. Then I thought. No. Must I? Then take. And I struck in the hollow place. I never saw him fall. The old father never turned his head. He is deaf and childish, gentlemen. Nobody saw him fall. I ran out. Nobody saw. As he had been scrambling amongst the boulders of the Raven and now found herself, all out of breath, standing amongst the heavy shadows of the rocky islet. The Raven is connected with the mainland by a natural pier of immense and slippery stones. She intended to return home that way. Was he still standing there? At home. Home. Four idiots and a corpse. She must go back and explain. Anybody would understand. Below her the night, or the sea seemed to pronounce distinctly, aha, I see you at last. She started, slipped, fell, and without attempting to rise, listened, terrified. She heard heavy breathing, a clatter of wooden clogs. It stopped. Where the devil did you pass? Said an invisible man, hoarsely. She held her breath. She recognized the voice. As he had not seen him fall. Was he pursuing her there dead, or perhaps... alive? She lost her head. She cried from the crevice where she lay huddled, never, never. Ah, you are still there. You led me a fine dance. Wait, my beauty, I must see how you look after all this. You wait. Millet was stumbling, laughing, swearing meaninglessly out of pure satisfaction, pleased with himself for having run down that fly by night. As if there were such things as ghosts. Bah! It took an old African soldier to show those clodhoppers. But it was curious. Who the devil was she? Susan listened, crouching. He was coming for her, this dead man. There was no escape. What a noise he made amongst the stones. She saw his head rise up, then the shoulders. He was tall, her own man. His long arms waved about, And it was his own voice sounding a little strange. Dot dot because of the scissors. She scrambled out quickly, rushed to the edge of the causeway, and turned round. The man stood still on a high stone, detaching himself in dead black on the glitter of the sky. "Where are you going to?" he called, roughly. She answered, "Home," and watched him intensely. He made a striding, clumsy leap onto another boulder, and stopped again, balancing himself, then said, "Ha, ha. Well, I am going with you. It's the least I can do. Ha, ha, ha." She stared at him till her eyes seemed to become glowing coals that burned deep into her brain, and yet she was in mortal fear of making out the well-known features. Below her the sea lapped softly against the rock with a splash continuous and gentle. The man said, "Advancing another step, I am coming for you. What do you think?" She trembled. Coming for her. There was no escape, no peace, no hope. She looked round despairingly. Suddenly the whole shadowy coast, the blurred islets, the heaven itself, swayed about twice, then came to a rest. She closed her eyes and shouted, "Can't you wait till I am dead?" She was shaken by a furious hate for that shade that pursued her in this world, unappeased even by death in its longing for an heir that would be like other people's children. "Hey! What?" said Millet, keeping his distance prudently. He was saying to himself, "Look out. Some lunatic. An accident happened soon." She went on, wildly, "I want to live. To live alone for a week, for a day. I must explain to them. ... I would tear you to pieces, I would kill you 20 times over, rather than let you touch me while I live. How many times must I kill you, you blasphemer? Satan sends you here. I am damned too." "Come," said Millet, alarmed and conciliating. I am perfectly alive. ... Oh, my God." As he had screamed, alive. And at once vanished before his eyes, as if the islet itself had swerved aside from under her feet. Millet rushed forward, and fell flat with his chin over the edge. Far below he saw the water whiten by her struggles, and heard one shrill cry for help that seemed to dart upwards along the perpendicular face of the rock, and soar past, straight into the high and impassive heaven. Madame Leveille sat, dry-eyed, on the short grass of the hillside, with her thick legs stretched out, and her old feet turned up in their black cloth shoes. Her clog stood nearby, and further off the umbrella lay on the withered sword like a weapon dropped from the grasp of a vanquished warrior. The Marquis of Chavannes, on horseback, one gloved hand on thigh, looked down at her as she got up laboriously, with groans. On the narrow track of the seaweed carts, four men were carrying inland Susan's body on a hand barrow, while several others straggled listlessly behind. Madame Leveille looked after the procession. "Why, yes, Monsieur le Marquis," she said dispassionately, in her usual calm tone of a reasonable old woman. "There are unfortunate people on this earth. I had only one child. Only one. And they won't bury her in consecrated ground." Her eyes filled suddenly, and a short shower of tears rolled down the broad cheeks. She pulled the shawl close about her. The Marquis leaned slightly over in his saddle, and said, "It is very sad. You have all my sympathy. I shall speak to the cure." She was unquestionably insane, and the fall was accidental. Millet said so distinctly. "Good day, madam." And he trotted off, thinking to himself, "I must get this old woman appointed guardian of those idiots, and administrator of the farm. It would be much better than having here one of those other Bacchus, probably a red Republican, corrupting my commune." An outpost of progress. There were two white men in charge of the trading station. Kurtz, the chief, was short and fat. Carlier, the assistant, was tall, with a large head and a very broad trunk perched upon a long pair of thin legs. The third man on the staff was a Sierra Leone nigger, who maintained that his name was Henry Price. However, for some reason or other, the natives down the river had given him the name of Makola, and it stuck to him through all his wanderings about the country. He spoke English and French with a warbling accent, wrote a beautiful hand, understood bookkeeping, and cherished in his innermost heart the worship of evil spirits. His wife was a negress from Luanda, very large and very noisy. Three children rolled about in sunshine before the door of his low, shed-like dwelling. Makola, taciturn and impenetrable, despised the two white men. He had charge of a small clay storehouse with a dried grass roof, and pretended to keep a correct account of beads, cotton cloth, red kerchiefs, brass wire, and other trade goods it contained. Besides the storehouse and Makola's hut, there was only one large building in the cleared ground of the station. It was built neatly of reeds, with a veranda on all the four sides. There were three rooms in it. The one in the middle was the living room, and had two rough tables and a few stools in it. The other two were the bedrooms for the white men. Each had a bedstead and a mosquito net for all furniture. The plank floor was littered with the belongings of the white men, open half-empty boxes, torn wearing apparel, old boots, all the things dirty, and all the things broken, that accumulate mysteriously around untidy men. There was also another dwelling place some distance away from the buildings. In it, under a tall cross much out of the perpendicular, slept the man who had seen the beginning of all this, who had planned, and had watched the construction of this outpost of progress. He had been, at home, an unsuccessful painter who, weary of pursuing fame on an empty stomach, had gone out there through high protections. He had been the first chief of that station. Makola had watched the energetic artist die of fever in the just-finished house with his usual kind of, told you so indifference. Then, for a time, he dwelt alone with his family, his account books, and the evil spirit that rules the lands under the equator. He got on very well with his god. Perhaps he had propitiated him by a promise of more white men to play with, by and by. At any rate, the director of the great trading company, coming up in a steamer that resembled an enormous sardine box with a flat roof shed erected on it, found the station in good order, and Makola as usual quietly diligent. The director at the cross put up over the first agent's grave, and appointed Kaerts to the post. Carlier was told off as second in charge. The director was a man ruthless and efficient, who at times, but very imperceptibly, indulged in grim humor. He made a speech to Kaerts and Carlier, pointing out to them the promising aspect of their station. The nearest trading post was about 300 miles away. It was an exceptional opportunity for them to distinguish themselves, and to earn percentages on the trade. This appointment was a favor done to beginners. Kaerts was moved almost to tears by his director's kindness. He would, he said, by doing his best, try to justify the flattering confidence, and see Kaerts had been in the administration of the telegraphs, and knew how to express himself correctly. Carlier, an ex-non-commissioned officer of cavalry in an army guaranteed from harm by several European powers, was less impressed. If there were commissions to get, so much the better, and, trailing a sulky glance over the river, the forests, the impenetrable bush, that seemed to cut off the station from the rest of the world, he muttered between his teeth, "We shall see, very soon." Next day, some bales of cotton goods and a few cases of provisions having been thrown on shore, the sardine box steamer went off, not to return for another 6 months. On the deck, the director touched his cap to the two agents, who stood on the bank waving their hats, and turning to an old servant of the company on his passage to headquarters, said, "Look at those two imbeciles. They must be mad at home, to send me such specimens. I told those fellows to plant a vegetable garden, build new storehouses and fences, and construct a landing stage. I bet nothing will be done. They won't know how to begin. I always thought the station on this river useless, and they just fit the station." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.